And now the early music show. For the next hour, we're in Georgian London as Lucy Skeeping finds out about a London concert series which opened its doors for the first time 250 years ago this year.
From 1765, for some 17 years, two enterprising men ran the most important and influential concert series in Georgian London, which soon became an essential part of life for the fashionable set. The two men in question were not only musicians themselves, both of them accomplished players and composers, but they were also old friends. And interestingly, both of them were German, Johann Christian Bach and Carl Friedrich Abel. So how did these two foreigners get started on such an enterprise? What sort of music could be heard and who performed it? And most importantly, perhaps, how was it all paid for? Well, to find out more in today's Early Music Show, I've invited the music historian Simon Hayes to join me in the studio. Many thanks for coming in, Simon. Now, how much do we actually know about the Bach-Abel concerts? And in particular, what sort of music was performed in them?
Well, they were such exclusive concerts that it was thought much too vulgar to advertise the programmes or the performers in advance. So actually, we have very few details about exactly what went on. It's a case of looking at contemporary diaries and newspapers and published music and seeing if we can pick up a few clues. But I think there is one thing we can definitely be certain of, and that's the tone of the concerts, which was above all elegant, exclusive, and I think surprisingly cutting edge. Audiences were treated to the latest musical developments, like the very first string quartets ever heard in England.
Thank you.
the finale from the String Quartet in A Major, Opus 8, Number 5, by Carl Friedrich Abel. And that was the Salomon Quartet. So, Simon Hayes, just who was Abel and what was his relationship to J.C. Bach?
Well, Carl Friedrich Abel was an excellent all-round musician. He played a wide variety of instruments, but was best known, I think, as a virtuoso on the viola da gamba. I think he was also a pretty good composer. And he arrived in London in 1758, 3 years before Johann Christian Bach, who was, of course, the youngest of Johann Sebastian's 11 children. Probably Johann Christian Bach was the most cosmopolitan of all the Bachs. And his big thing was opera, but he was also a very good composer of instrumental music. And I think in many ways his stature and his cosmopolitanism, if I can use that word, mark him out as Handel's natural successor in England. And he arrived just 3 years after Handel died.
He'd known Abel, hadn't he, sort of in Germany a bit?
That's right. I mean, one of the things that links both Bach and Abel is that they were both taught by Johann Sebastian Bach. In fact, Abel's dad, also a gamba player, was probably the chap who Johann Sebastian intended Brandenburg Six for in some of his gamba solos. There's a very interesting heritage there. In England, Bach and Abel really got on well together. They played at court, they had famous friends in common like Gainsborough, and it seems they got on well enough actually to set up house together, sharing rooms in Soho in 1764.
So during the course of this concert series, Bach and Abel managed to attract some of the leading instrumentalists from Europe to come to London to perform.
Yes, I think they actually visited the continent and snapped a few of them up. And we know that Johann Christian went to Mannheim and engaged Wilhelm Kramer. He'd been playing with a great Mannheim orchestra and engaged him to play at the Bach-Abel concerts to lead them, in fact, from 1773. Back in England, Abel has two young cello protégés, John Crosdill and James Cervetto, who really then play all the solos and he coaches them for all the concertos. And then finally, at some stage, we don't know when, Bach or Abel went to Italy and engaged the Italian flautist Pietro Florio. And back in Germany, they got the great oboist Johann Christian Fischer, who was also a marvellous composer. And then the great thing is that this little group of violinist, cellist and flautist and oboist were this core, this troupe of instrumentalists at the core of all the music that was composed. And we're going to hear a delightful quintet in D, which puts them all together, and J.C. Bach himself solos on the harpsichord.
Thank you.
Lovely, graceful sound that. That was the Andantino from a quintet by J.C. Bach, performed there by members of the English Concert. So, Simon, how did these Bach Arbel concerts kind of work in practice? I mean, could anyone just turn up and buy a ticket?
No. It's interesting. One of the things that they really pioneer here is that this is a subscription concert series. So you had to pay for all your tickets in one go at the beginning, which cost Bach and Arbel subscribers a hefty 5 guineas for 15 concerts. But that wasn't the only way that they made sure that their audience were rich and exclusive. They didn't advertise programmes in the press, but what they did do was to advertise the audience. They used to list in the newspapers all the famous aristocrats and all the famous people in order to encourage similar to apply.
So you mean if he's going, I'm going?
But just because you were rich and famous didn't mean you'd get in. You then had to be vetted by a number of society women who had lists which had names on of who was in and out. And only if you'd passed their scrutiny could you actually get in through the doors.
So where were they held? I mean, is this a large concert hall or some little private room? How did it work?
They had three different venues which got gradually larger. They started out in 1765 at Carlisle House in Soho, which was the home of their collaborator and society queen, Teresa Cornelis. And the concerts were held weekly between January and May on a Wednesday evening, and Bach and Arbel directed alternately. And they were really going great guns, so they had to move to Almack's room in King Street in 1768. And finally, they built their own rooms with several other entrepreneurs at Hanover Square in 1775. And because at this time subscriptions were capped at about 500, that must have been about the natural number of seats you could have got in.
So what was the atmosphere like, Simon? Was it like modern concert when you have to be a bit quiet and very embarrassed if you cough?
No, absolutely not. Think of an elegant drawing room with chairs and sofas and things around the walls, and there was an invitation to walk round and talk to your friends if you wanted to. And if they bored you, then certainly at Hanover Square Rooms you could admire the wonderful lighting. Apparently there used to be candles behind translucent paintings by Gainsborough and some of his colleagues.
What about the music itself? I mean, was there a great variety of sort of styles?
Yes, huge variety. Everything from solo, chamber, orchestral and vocal music. And we know from Bach's bank accounts that he did actually book leading opera stars who sang individual arias, probably from Bach's own London operas. La Clemenza di Scipione of 1778 contains an absolutely ideal aria, which has exactly the same solo quartet we heard in the Andantino a moment ago. It was that classic Arbel ensemble of flute, oboe, violin and cello. Interestingly, Mozart must have known this aria because he writes a similar one 4 years later in Die Entführung for the same four solo instruments. In Bach's aria, in Felice, in Van Mafano, we hear the haughty Spanish princess Arsinda absolutely tormented at the prospect of having to sacrifice her dignity and beg for the life of her beloved.
And we're going to hear that now. This is Linda Perillo, the soprano.
Thank you.
That was Linda Perillo with Das Kleine Konzert, directed by Hermann Max. Actually, Linda took ages to come in, didn't she? It's a wonderful piece. It was by J.C. Bach. It was Infelice Infan Mafano from his opera La Clemenza di Scipione. Yes, it was an immensely long introduction, wasn't it?
To show off those four instrumentalists. Yeah, marvellous.
Yeah. Now, Bach and Abel then brought over these top opera singers to perform arias like that in their concert series. Must have been quite an expensive business. I'm intrigued as to how they funded this.
Prying into Bach's bank account at Drummond's, we can see just how much people were paid. It's fascinating to be able to do this, actually. We know that he paid the top operatic singers not for individual nights but for the whole season. They were obviously kind of booked for a decent time and it was worth getting them over. So in 1772 he paid Cecilia Grassi the princely sum of 100 guineas for singing in all 15 nights. That compares with £60 for Crosdill the cellist and about 15 for a rank and file fiddler. I think Bach was very impressed with Cecilia Grassi because a few years later he actually married her. But it is clear from the bank accounts that both Bach and Abel made considerable profits. So because they nearly always operated at full capacity, in 1774 we know they took £2,625. And once they paid £500 for rent, £700 in fees, that gave them nearly 50% profit, which was a lot of money.
It's brilliant, these two obviously great musicians were also good businessmen, because those two things don't always go together, do they?
That's right. Sometimes when Bach-Abel concerts have been discussed in the past, people say, well, because they fade out at the end a little bit, they weren't good businessmen. But actually, the evidence of Bach's bank account suggests that for many years, at least a decade, they were bringing home a really decent taking.
So how did Bach and Abel kind of maintain the success of these concerts over nearly two decades?
I think it was because they stayed on top of fashion and they introduced London audiences to the latest styles of orchestral music, which was chiefly being developed in Germany, which, of course, you know, they knew all about. And they often popped over to keep an ear on what was going on. And the most exciting thing that was going on was the development of the symphony. They both published several collections of symphonies that were almost certainly performed at these concerts. And it's through these works that their elite London audiences first got a taste of what today I suppose we'd call the classical style. And it's interesting actually because on the one hand you've got the exclusivity of audiences and this also extended to the music. Because Bach and Abel wanted to offer an exclusive product not available anywhere else, they only performed their own music. And Abel was especially famous for his graceful and deeply felt adagios.
Thank you.
a movement from Symphony in A Major by Carl Friedrich Abel, an example of what the exclusive West End concert series run by J.C. Bach and his friend Abel could offer back in the late 18th century. And the performers there were La Stagione Frankfurt, directed by Michael Schneider. Simon Hayes, Bach and Abel really did keep their audiences supplied with symphonies and concertos in the latest style, albeit all their own music. What other kind of cutting-edge developments did they exploit that would attract people?
Well, one of the most important things happening in London, not in Europe, actually, this is a very specifically London-based thing in the 1760s and 70s, was the development of a novel new keyboard instrument, which, unlike the harpsichord, could play both loud and soft. It was, of course, the piano. And we know that he was one of the first to play the piano in public in 1768, but he must surely have played it earlier than that at the Bach-Abel concerts.
Square piano of the Georgian period. It's a gorgeous, almost bell-like tone, isn't it? That was the brilliant David Owen Norris tinkling the ivories with the players from the group Sonnery in Piano Concerto in G by Bach's youngest son, J.C. Bach, known, of course, as the London Bach. So, Simon, as you were saying earlier, all the music in these concerts was actually written by Bach and Abel, but in the absence of any contemporary programmes or advertisements, we don't know which particular pieces. Now, you were telling us earlier quite a lot of information about Bach's bank account, which is fascinating, but what exactly do we know about what was performed at the concerts?
Really not a great deal. The key is actually the music that was published. And in publishing something, you're going to want to really sell it. And so what Bach and some of his singers did was to publish the songs or some of the instrumental pieces that had been performed and say on the title page, recently heard at the Bach-Abel concerts. And that was, you know, a good way to promote sales. And also tell us a fair bit about the performers. So in 1778, there was a concert aria published, Eben Zivada, and its title page says, sung by Mr. Tenducci at Messrs. Bach and Abel's concert. And we know that Tenducci was a soprano castrato, and from lots of his publications, we know that he was a regular and probably also a great favourite and friend of the organisers.
We're going to hear an aria now that Tenducci would have sung. What's it about?
Well, it's a classic operatic scene of parted lovers. Rinaldo is railing and lamenting that you're never going to see his beloved again, and Bach cleverly cast this as a rondo, so we get this lovely haunting melody that comes back again and again, just like Rinaldo's love.
Just today.
What an amazing soprano, and he's all man. That was Philippe Jarouski with Le Cercle de l'Harmonie, directed by Jeremy Rohrer, in J.C. Bach's concert aria, Eben Sivada. Sam, we know that Bach himself played both the harpsichord and the piano at these concerts. What was Abel's role?
Well, he directed his own concerts from the harpsichord. He played the cello in Bach's concerts, but his fame was really based on his ability as a virtuoso of the viola da gamba, kind of really quite an old-fashioned instrument at this time. I think probably he came to London and realised that this was something that set him apart from others, because nobody else played this instrument. And it was part of his heritage, you know, his father played it. And I thought we'd listen to begin with to an adagio. He was meant to be wonderful at playing adagios. Bernie says he almost breathes the notes. And in this one, it's almost as though he's remembering his lessons with Bach Sr.
Suzanne Heinrich on the viol de gamba in Carl Friedrich Abel's instrument of choice, you might say. And those two solos were composed by him. So, I mean, that was a really beautifully moving slow movement. Only a viola da gamba could play like that. It's the way the notes ring, because, of course, the instrument's fretted. You mentioned that Abel was famous for these kind of adagios, but that second movement was a little bit more upbeat, bit of a jig, wasn't it?
Yes, according to contemporary accounts, Abel was terribly good at playing something slow like that, which apparently could bring tears to the eyes of all, and then suddenly he liked to switch moods, and nothing would stop him until, I quote, he made his friend Gainsborough dance a hornpipe on the bottom of a pewter quart pot. And I think we just heard that in that last movement.
So the Bach-Abel concerts ran for some 16, 17 years. What happened towards the end?
Well, you look at Bach's bank account and you can see that really from the late 1770s and early 1780s, you know, the receipts are not as good as they had been. And I think, you know, fatigue was setting in. Audiences had been lured to other subscription concerts set up in imitation of these. And also, I mean, not unexpectedly, hearing, you know, a diet of pure Bach and Abel all the time began to bore people. And other concerts were offering upstarts like Joseph Haydn, for instance. And I think the nail in the coffin was really when Bach himself dies on the 1st of January 1782. Abel struggles on for one more season, but effectively the concerts are over at that point. But if you look at the music of the very last years, there's no dip in quality. In fact, quite the reverse. It's almost as if Bach in particular realised the audiences were going away, and so he made a special effort. And particularly his later symphonies, those posthumously published as Opus 18, contains some absolutely stunning music. He brings in the latest ideas from Mannheim, and several of these symphonies are actually written for double orchestra. And I thought we'd end with one of them, which was written in 1779 and was one of two which stayed in the repertory until the early 19th century, perhaps the longest lasting legacy of the Bach-Abel concerts.
Simon Hayes, thanks very much. Thank you.
The first movement, Spiritoso, from the Symphony in E-flat, Opus 18, Number 1, by Johann Christian Bach, the London Bach, bringing today's early music show to an end. It was played by the Academy of Ancient Music, directed by Simon Standage. The early music show was presented by Lucy Skeeping, and the producer was Peter Thresh. And in next week's programme, Lucy will be looking at the intricacies of medieval dance with the choreographer and early dance expert, Darren Royston. That's at the same time, 2 o'clock next week.
Coming up in an hour's time on Radio 3, our weekly celebration of singing together in the choir. I'll be exploring the full range of choral singing today, with music from Heinrich Schütz to Meredith Monk and the Mills Brothers. My guest is the director of Cheltenham Music Festival, Meirig Bowen. He'll be talking about some of his favourite choral music. And at 5 o'clock, my choral classic is the Monteverdi Vespers. Join me, Sarah Moore-Peach, for the choir at 4 o'clock.
Well, this is BBC Radio 3. It's time now for another in our series of Archive Choral Evensong. Today's service was first broadcast live from the Chapel of Trinity College, Cambridge, on the 29th of April, 1992. The choir is directed by Richard Marlowe, fellow, organist and director of music at Trinity for 38 years, between 1968 and 2006. He died in June 2013. The music in today's service is all by English and German composers of the 17th and 18th centuries. The canticles are sung to the setting in C by Maurice Greene, and for the anthem, the choir sings Bach's motet Jesu meine Freude. It's a substantial work scored in 5 parts for unaccompanied choir, and it's based on the hymn Jesu meine Freude by Johannes Frank. In Bach's setting, each of the 6 verses of the hymn uses a form of the chorale melody, and between the verses there are 5 freely composed sections, each setting a verse from the letter to the Romans, chapter 8. The service opens now with words from Psalm 139 in a setting by Johannes Krapps. Erforsche mich Gott, try me, O God, and seek the ground of my heart. Prove me and examine my thoughts.
Thank you. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit. A broken and a contrite heart, O God, thou wilt not despise.
O Lord, open thou our lips.
And the mouth shall show forth thy praise.
O God, make speed to save us.
O Lord, make haste to help us.
Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Ghost.
As it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end.
Praise ye the Lord.
The Lord's name be
The Psalms this evening are numbers 142 and 143.